This is Decentralized, the Decentralized Trials and Research Podcast. We gather here with friends and guests to talk about the latest ways to make research and clinical trials around the world more inclusive, more accessible, more resilient, and more sustainable, all by using decentralized methods. This podcast is recorded live on Clubhouse every Friday, 12 to 1 Eastern, on the TGIF DCT show at the Decentralized Trials Club. You can join the live sessions and add your voice every Friday at noon Eastern time with the free Clubhouse app by following the Decentralized Trials Club. And of course, subscribe to this podcast on your favorite platform to get notified of new episodes. Following the club and subscribing will also help you stay current for any of the bonus content we may drop. And now, it's time to decentralize.
Hello and welcome, and thank you for joining us on this week's TGIF DTRA. If you're gathering with us here live on a Friday afternoon, or on the Decentralized podcast, if you're one of the many who enjoys catching up at a later date when it works best for you and your busy lives. Either way, we gather here every Friday afternoon, or many Friday afternoons, with different guests as we talk about thoughts and ideas, practices, experiences, data and evidence, all related to innovations that are helping to make trial participation more accessible for all. And our guests are folks who are bringing that to life, whether through technology, operations, service models, and other creative approaches, whether conversations that reach into the legal and compliance concerns, straight through to the operational and technical. We have it all. And so if there's a topic you'd love to see us cover in the weeks and months ahead, please feel free to reach out. You can always ping folks like myself, Amir Kalali, Jane Miles on LinkedIn or whatever other social platforms you like, or you can always drop an email to secretariat@dtra.org. Let us know if there's a topic you'd love to hear us cover in the weeks and months ahead, or if you have a topic you'd like to cover, maybe you have a paper coming out, a presentation you're building up. This is a great opportunity to share that more broadly with the community, take a few questions live from folks. With that in mind, I'm really looking forward to today's conversation. There's a lot of different headlines that might talk about site networks and different ways of engaging with providers in the community, especially in specific therapeutic areas like oncology. With that in mind, I'm really thrilled that we've got some interesting guests with us this week, right, Jane?
Yeah, some interesting guests that we've been following for a while because they keep doing interesting things, trying to push this innovation curve forward.
What say you, Amir? Should we dive right in?
Yes, please.
Let's go ahead then. With that, I'm thrilled to welcome Noelle Gaskill and Carla Polk, who are joining us today from Tempus, and more specifically within Tempus, the Time Network. Noelle, Carla, welcome. For folks that haven't had the pleasure to meet you yet, Noelle, maybe you could get us started. Introduce yourself and what it is you do by day.
Sure, I'm happy to. And thank you for having us on today. It's always exciting to share with you guys. As our sites and investigators continue to make progress in the space, I don't want anything to be a secret. I love getting the word out there. So thank you. So I've been in clinical research way too long, been around a long time, mostly in oncology. So I've run large scale networks. I've worked in biotech. And what's funny is a large part of that time, Carla has been with me. So you'll hear some similar background as that has been the legacy. But we at Time and Tempus, I really came to Tempus because this sounds really cheesy, but if it doesn't work here, I don't know where else to go. And I had worked in biotech and said, look, let's do DCT. And, you know, that was really fun. And we'll share about that experience, I'm sure, today. And I had another biotech offer, but I said, I really want to do this with all sites and all pipelines. And so this being really my passion all along has been to have access for community-based patients and access to all novel therapeutics. Here at Tyme, we work with community and academics, but the challenges are the same. You know, how do we get a trial to all patients? And so that really is my every day, is trying to figure that out. And when I came to Tyme Tempus about 18 months or so ago, DCT was not a component of the innovation that they were doing here. They have just-in-time models, they have scale, we have 800 locations for clinical research, but no DCT. And so for me, it became a must-have of making this a component of what we do every day.
Looking forward to hearing more about what that means. And also, I might even ask you in a moment, Noelle, to just even back up and make sure folks know who Tempus is and what the company more broadly works on. But before we do that, Carla, I'd love to hear from you and what it is you are looking after in the Tyme Tempus metaverse.
Yes, thank you for having us. I'm excited to be here. By way of background, I've also have many years of clinical research experience, all of them within oncology. I started my career at a large research network where I ran their operations team. I then transitioned and worked at a global CRO where I was running global clinical trials. And then before coming to Tyme and the within Tempus, I was also at a biotech. Really, my goal there was to prioritize enrollment to clinical trials. And that's really where I focused in on doing cool and amazing things, including the decentralized clinical trial model. So it's exciting to be able to bring my experience to our research network, where again, I have to echo Noel's comments of, you know, what my North Star is being able to bring clinical trial access to patients where they are and thinking of ways that we can think outside of the typical standard boxes and solve for patient care. And I think those are key things that we're doing each and every day here within the Tyme Network. Thank
I
you.
love how you your stories, your backgrounds kind of embody this superpower that's out there today when folks are travelers and have this experience that can span from sponsors to CROs to the research site network and the associated technology that's required for that. I think that's a superpower, both in terms of just understanding, you know, the empathy for the different stakeholders and their perspectives, but really to understand how to make sure these fit and fit for everyone involved. But before we dig in, Noelle, I wonder if I could bounce back to you for a moment. For folks that may not be familiar with Tempus, who is Tempus?
That's a great question, and thank you for the question. So Tempus was founded about 10 years ago by Eric Lefkofsky, our CEO, really out of his experiences. He talks about it publicly a lot, of his wife having been a patient and how data was just not there, right? It wasn't guiding. It wasn't easy to access. You know, the path was unclear. He lived all of that. And so, you know, thankfully he just said, he's a founder of Groupon and said, you know what, I'm going to apply everything I've learned in data and technology and try to help in this situation. And that's really where it was birthed out of. So today we're a data and a healthcare company, data and technology at its core. And it's really our differentiators, as well as we'll talk about some of what we do every day. But we are also a genomics company. So in oncology, of course, when we're looking to have patients on trial, that's everything. So, you know, it's an alphabet soup on top of an alphabet soup. Literally, that's the kind of trials I'm seeing now, where I thought I knew KRAS G12C, but now it's PD-L1 high, KRAS G12C, and then there's probably going to be something added to that tomorrow. So it's a needle in a haystack in oncology. And so Tempus is really poised to bring all the pieces together that our patients need to have successful identification and enrollment on a trial, meaning there's the data there where we can actually see within the EHR multimodal level data at the patient level. It's not just limited to our genomics. We have a data connected site network, and that's really the differentiator. It's not transactional. It's not one trial, at one site. It's really that we're connected to these practices. We have that data insight, and then the genomics, if it's at Tempus or elsewhere, we can see that as well. And we surface these patients, help them enroll onto the trial effectively because, again, it's complex and the data is complex, but also the sites don't have time. So from a time network standpoint, we leverage the backbone of Tempus, being the genomics and the data company that it is, to be able to help us identify and enroll these patients.
So Tempus is working with these clinical centers, whether academic or community-based, around molecular profiling and compiling data. Is that all for research use, or is some of that going back to those centers and how they're delivering care? And then it sounds like the Time Network is a subset of that ecosystem that is ready to be investigators in these studies.
That's right. We are a one-stop shop for clinical development. So not everything is research. We have a CRO. We have this clinical research network time that you guys are learning about. And we have data to inform, real-world evidence, organoids. It literally is like an end-to-end for clinical development, is how I would position Tempus in the world that we sit in here. But it goes much more beyond that. We've had acquisition of Ambry. Paige is a more recent acquisition as well, where they can apply AI onto histology so that they can say from imaging if there is a potential alteration with the IHC slide, and therefore we're not wasting tissue. I mean, every single day, Tempus surprises me with the pieces that they're pulling together to say, actually, we can wrap around these patients and we can provide them, more effective care ultimately. You had a question about the data and how it's used with the practices. We actually go, well, again, beyond the clinical research walls of the data and the practices. One of the coolest things I think that we do is we have pathway tooling where the data that's being surfaced at the practice level can actually inform a treating provider as to, hey, maybe this patient needs to get tested as they're moving into the second line. They might have a KRAS G12C alteration, and that would be a therapeutic option for that patient if they come back as being, let's say, mutated for that. In this complex world, in this very, very busy world with the providers and the practices, who doesn't want help like that? And we don't dictate it. It's just surface for providers to be able to say, oh, that's a great insight, or based on this again alteration, this is what I should do. This is the NCCN guideline. I can't remember the exact quote, but it's something like 226 different pages in breast cancer. I mean, who can possibly remember that from an NCCN guideline standpoint? So, again, I would say we wrap around the providers and the patients and making their clinical care as informed and easy as possible.
And the Time Network itself, then, these aren't Tempus-owned clinical sites. These are independent practices where there's a competency around research that you're connecting around data and other some shared infrastructure there as well.
That's right. We have such a terrific base of practices that are absolutely independent of Tempus time, so to speak. We don't own them. We're not a site management organization, as I know everybody's familiar with some networks that are. So we are, I say we're a network of networks. We partner with OneOncology. We had them on the webinar yesterday talking about their DCT model as an example. And we're there to support them with the clinical trials, the patient matching technology, the nurses that help them with that. Surfacing their patients for their trials, and then also operating these studies. And that's what Carla does all day. We have a study startup timeline that averages 8 weeks for any study that we do across all of oncology pharma. So that's why they come to us, but we are not them. They remain intact. If you're a network, if you're a community-based practice, if you're an academic center, we are complementing and helping reduce that burden for them.
Jane, I can. Oh, go ahead, Amir.
There's so many questions. I'm going to pretend to be this someone who knows nothing about oncology or clinical trials. So I'm just trying to understand from everything you said, Noel. You kind of talked about being end to end. From some people might think you're trying to vertically integrate and own the sites. It doesn't look like you own the sites. How does this fit with the large global CROs or the specialty oncology CROs? Because you own your own CRO too. So how does that work?
Yeah, so the CRO is there if someone is, obviously in search of such CRO services, but it's I would say Tempus has a lot and it's a la carte. I would with that said though, I would say always think about data, right? No matter what we're doing together with our life science partners, data should be a component of it because it's just so informative, no matter if you're in clinical research or if you're looking for a site selection, let's say. But with that said, CRO is there for as an option for those who may want to opt in, and in particular, working with our sites and knowing our sites. How to operate with them, that's the CRO is there if needed. Our clinical research network works with all CROs. So if you come in as, pharma company A and you have a strategic partnership with one of the top three, let's say CROs, we've worked with them and we probably are working with them. So Carla loves to tell, I think you guys encounter this in DCT where, the CRO comes along and says, we can't do this. Can't, no, stop, everybody, we can't do this. We are here to actually say, well, no, we're working with these seven people at the CRO right now, and they know how to do this with us. Let's go. And so I think that's exactly where we help with DCTs and that we do this all day for just-in-time models as well. We have the efficiencies, we have the sites who know how to do this, and we help bridge the CRO, the sponsor, and the sites in operating.
Great.
Jane, I'm sure you have some questions popping up in your mind.
But I'm going to go back to that metric, that 12-week startup time metric. Let's dig there just for a sec. So first, in your time sites, is that community only? Is it academics? And how does that work? And then how do you think that 12-week startup time is relevant?
I'm gonna let Carla answer all of these. She does it every day.
Yeah, thanks for the question, Jane. So first, we do have a large number of community practices within our network. We know that most, that's where the majority of oncology patients are seen. But we also partner with academic medical centers that are doing this, and we are always like to brag that we can do just-in-time models with academic medical centers. And we also know that these centers and both community and AMCs have decentralized models that they're already currently activating, as we shared on our webinar yesterday. In terms of our site rapid study startup and activation timelines, our customers and our sponsors are always looking for meeting those critical milestones, being able to get to enrollment as fast as possible. And that's where they continue to come to us to say, we know that we can leverage your efficiencies, your operational pillars that allow you to get to those 12-week startup timelines. So when we think about why that's important, I always think about really ultimately the goal is to be able to put patients on clinical trials and to be able to do it in a rapid fashion. From a sponsor's perspective, we understand that it is key that they are in a very competitive landscape. So the faster they can get to enrollment, to the start of enrollment, is the faster that they can get to completed enrollment and then ultimately the data, because that's what's from a sponsor perspective is critical.
So let's go back to something you mentioned. A lot of, and I'm not quoting exactly, but you said a lot of these sites, both community and academics, already have DCT methods they're implementing.
Yeah.
What does that look like? And then how do you deal with it if they have some differences in how they're implementing? And the bonus question is, how do you push them into the elements they haven't yet tried?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'll start and then, no, I'll start and then maybe hand it over to you. I personally think it's okay that these organizations don't always have that same DCT model because we understand that every practice is different. They have different working instructions, different SOPs, different technologies. So what we found has been successful not only here within Tempus and Time, but also in our past experience working at Biotech is these organizations are already doing and setting up models that help them reach all of their patients. If you have a large institution that has many number of practices and locations across a given area, and they are all under the same technology, the same practices, they can leverage their infrastructure to really support enrollment into a clinical trial in a DCT hybrid model. So maybe they're not calling it that, but in reality, it is what it is, a hybrid DCT model. So the ultimate goal of being able to have the infrastructure, the playbook set up, what is success at one practice may look different from a different practice. And we are happy to support that here within Time. We're making the connection with our sponsors on a specific clinical trial to give them visibility and connecting them to those practices so that they can leverage what is already put in place and the infrastructure that's already being utilized at our individual
So
sites.
you act a little bit as a navigator between the site and the sponsor to help them get over what I'll call their risk curve. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. And I think Noel mentioned this. We are very familiar with having to navigate that initial risk. We do this all the time for a just-in-time model. When we tell a sponsor or a CRO that we can get their study up and running in like 6 to 8 weeks and that we can open a site within 14 days, you can hear the gasp of like, no way, it's not going to happen. But we have our processes. We've run through, let's walk through this day by day, let's talk about it, bringing in the key stakeholders on their team to better understand, let's talk through this, let's give them some examples, some best practices, ultimately knowing that, they're the sponsors, they have their designated CROs and their vendors that we're working with, but leveraging, our experiences, our best practices, and kind of navigating that initial reaction to no way, but
When you get
it
that
can
no
happen.
way, is there are there certain profiles of studies that really fit for that hyper acceleration? Are there some that are really a no way, like not this type of protocol because of certain characteristics that you can point to?
I think that's a great question, Craig. And of course, there's always going to be a clinical trial that maybe it doesn't make sense because of the patient population, some of the operational logistics. But what I will say is that we do that at very early whenever we have an opportunity, is we review it and we make that determination to say, look, this is a great opportunity for this model. The great thing within our Time Network is that it's not all just in time. We can and we are opening studies in that are phase one, first in human, CAR T studies, where maybe just in time isn't the right approach, but we can do that. And now we're happy to expand into the DCT hybrid model as well.
So again, I'm going to play the someone who might be listening later on and goes, well, I hear a lot of people sell me all sorts of things that are faster, better, one day startup, whatever. So can you explain to me exactly how it is that you are doing whatever you're doing that's faster that the sponsors are sort of surprised by when they first hear it? What is it that you're doing exactly that's different to a traditional CRO or a sponsor?
I would say a couple of things that are key in differentiating for us outside of the technology aspect that Noel has talked about. We really leverage the ability and to streamline, I would say, three key pieces. One, from a contracting perspective, we have standardized templates that not only do we ask sponsors to agree to, but we ask our sites to agree to. So it really is a fast timeline. Also, in terms of our budgets, we do have standardized, and When people join our Time Network, when sites join and when sponsors join, we give them visibility to that. So there's that upfront agreement, which really limits the back and forth and the drawn out contract and budgeting timelines. And then we also, I think many institutions and organizations leverage standardized central IRB. So I would say those are three key pieces that we can leverage across all of our studies of many, many years and efficiencies that can really help us drive how to make sure that we're shortening that window.
So basically, what you're saying is the only people missing out would be the lawyers who don't have to spend money.
Those are the people that we talk to first.
Right. Thank you. Okay.
So I imagine a big part of that is also the data access that you have with these centers, how that may help you with feasibility. Are you kind of pre-identifying patients because of the data access that you have centrally, or are there other toolings that at the local site they're able to quickly identify and engage potential participants?
Exactly. We don't think that data is everything, but it's very, very helpful when you don't have a lot of time at the practice level. So yes, we when we turn on a study, just in time is powered by the fact that we're looking across all of our centers for the patient. And so then we turn on that location where that patient actually ends up being identified and consents. So that's where we get that acceleration, as well as the study startup acceleration for our sponsors. We were talking to a sponsor yesterday, and this is all credit to Carla. We told them, look, we have two first patient ends on two of your studies, and we think we have a third. So that means three different studies, first patient enrolled on all three. The combination of everything we're talking about, again, is where we accelerate, but it's also where it fits into DCT. If you can see a patient in, let's say, remote Tennessee, where there is a provider within the Tennessee oncology footprint, and the PI is in Chattanooga, and we can see that patient beyond the walls of the clinical research center, we can see them again at a maybe just a local oncologist center. That's the power of DCT. Then why not activate that study where the patient is at? And that Chattanooga PI might provide the oversight of that rural, oncology treating physician location, but the data is what maximizes the DCT model.
So with that, in that example, when you have that rural oncologist, where there might be a clinical research desert, are they becoming a sub-investigator, or are they just focused on the routine care aspects, and that PI in Chattanooga is covering all of the PI responsibilities?
Right. So the answer always is it depends. So what did our sites decide? What did the site base decide they're going to do? How are they comfortable providing oversight? But yes, that's the most common example is that we see the treating oncologist as a participant site as the regulations define. So they are participating on as a site, but they're not the clinical research site. And it keeps the Chattanooga in this example as the PI. And that's not necessarily a sub-I who is, again, it depends on the trial. In this example, you might say, well, that treating oncologist, the patient was randomized to standard of care. Well, they're perfectly able as a treating oncologist to treat that patient and follow them on standard of care. Another example that we've had in our past life when Carla and I were in biotech, we had a dose optimization study. And so that meant we were actually looking for patients to take the commercial product, an oral oncolytic, but follow them on a little bit of a lower dose to see if we could mitigate some of the toxicities. So again, this is a commercially available product. It's oral. Not everyone needs to be a sub-I, right? In fact, if anything, you're randomizing to potentially less toxicity. So there's still a PI, they're still following this patient, they can see them in real time because they're connected in their EHR system and through other operations, and they have a way of telemedicine and everything else already figured out. And so I think as we heard from our webinar participants yesterday, it's about getting the word out there to pharma and saying, you can do this and it's going to be okay. And that's the hard job Carla has, is like walking them through that as they deploy their trial.
I think I might
Want to
need
make
your help
sure.
on that. Here's why. Because we've done a lot of work this year on HCPs and how they could be involved, aligned to the guidance that's been published. And this week I was speaking with some of the folks who helped us conduct and sponsor the research. And I would say, even within this group of folks who are super motivated, there's this concern that this is not going to work in the actual clinical trial treatment domain. It'll work for recruitment, it'll work for follow-up, but not for the treatment phase. So help me give them some evidence to believe it could work.
Yeah, so I've actually been blessed by being on DTRA's TG, what is it, TGIF and not TGIF, but in this webinar talking about exactly that. If I, at a small biotech, could deploy an interventional oncology trial within the VA in a DCT model, I would challenge that anybody can do it. Meaning that if the VA has their own process of how to reach their patients, in a separate location with a treating oncologist, different from the PI's location, but with PI oversight, because the VA has, again, an integrated technology network, I would challenge that, again, there's almost any health system institution willing and wanting to do it, of course, can do this as well. And that's what we heard on our webinar yesterday. It was Texas Oncology, One Oncology, and OSU pleading pharma to do more with them because they've been doing this. And Texas Oncology's example was 4 years. They've been doing interventional oncolytic trials for 4 years, and they still hit the wall of just pharma or CRO saying no. Instead, I was honored to give them the platform of saying how. And hoping that, again, our life science partners come along. And I, by all means, respect the risk concern. But I think it's like, well, let's dive into that. What is the risk that is of concern? And then how do we get through that? One of the learnings I had in having this conversation within biotech was that biotech thought everything had to be, and I think a lot of sponsors do, everything has to be in the protocol. That means I need 17 different versions of this protocol. And that's actually not the case. So, that's a whole answer in itself. But I think every time there is a barrier thrown up, there is an answer. And it's just about getting the word out there of how have we worked with the FDA to make this happen before, and making sure those secrets, so to speak, are demystified.
So, are you saying we overcomplicate things?
Oncology clinical research, why didn't I choose another field? It cannot be more complex.
What I mean by that specifically, because I'm going to dive a little bit into what you said about everything needing to be in the protocol and specified. This comes up a lot. Like, but what if the timing for that blood draw is not actually aligned to standard of care? And what if it, what if, what if, what if? So, how do you help us get over that hump, Carla and Noel?
Also, so there was a great conversation that we had within the pharma company as the example where we deployed this protocol in a DCT model, but also same conversation ended up happening with the FDA. And it was around the concern or question of, well, how does all of these operations of the DCT model actually make it into the protocol? And the answer was, it doesn't need to be. So you might choose an example of like getting drug to the patient remotely. Again, the patient not being within the research center. Well, that needs to be in the protocol. And so I had to like time out everybody and say, having spent most of my career in the sites, you guys, they drive drug around. They drive it from one location to another. Like I can tell you, oncology consultants in Houston, that's what, our friend there does every day. And their jaws just drop. They do that. Oh yes, and it's not in your protocol. They figure it out. They have an SOP. They have temperature excursion. SOPs. They have training, and you go to their site, and you ask them how they get drug distributed to the different locations, they can tell you exactly how, they can show you the evidence of it, and they have, again, the standard operating procedure, and the CRO inspects it for you. They have their ways of operating, and that operation doesn't always need to be spelled out implicitly in the protocol. In fact, the protocol should be intentionally vague in certain spaces to allow for the operational nature of how our sites do what they do every day. And I think it's absolutely no different when you're talking about a decentralized trial.
So Noel, let me push on there a bit. So I think that's great. I do think being intentionally vague is a strategic option. However, do you think, is it legal? Is it regulatory groups that are too conservative? Is it operational people that actually hate vagueness and want absolutely everything tied down because apparently they get anxiety unless it is? Which groups within life sciences do you think are kind of the barrier, or just do they want to control everything? Who is it? Is it all of them? Is it what do you think the common problems are?
Well, I definitely don't think it's the sites who have figured it out. So I definitely do think we have see the level of caution, and again, understandably so. Nobody's a bad guy, and that's why we're talking today in life sciences, because they maybe haven't been at that site level or haven't been through a DCT model before, as it's still new to a lot of people, and so it's just an inherent discomfort. But I think it's about don't say no. But let's say how or why. Let's go through each of the questions and concerns, absolutely. And as long as I think our life science partners are opening themselves up to learning and getting comfortable with these models, I think all will be fine. And by all means, I did not mean to imply that DCT protocols need to be more vague than a standard protocol. Not at all. It's just where protocols don't spell out how drug is driven from one location to another, I would say your DCT protocol doesn't need to either.
So, and again, I'm just trying to work out, is it more about incentives? So when you describe how sites get it done, because their incentive is to work out how to get it done, to get patients in. Maybe within life science companies, the incentive is make sure nothing goes wrong, to sort of think of every risk. So is it more about people's personal kind of incentives?
I absolutely, for sure. And so I also think that life science companies, again, go back 10 years ago and DCT really wasn't DCT at all. Everything was about, the protocol needs to be the same for every site. The technology needs to be the same for every site. That's really, I think, the comfort level of understandably a sponsor and their vendors. They want everything to be the same. Why? Because you have to apply the oversight, you have to do the due diligence, you have to have the team them in the TMS. So that makes sense, like why they're only comfortable with consistency and the same thing happening, let's say. But then we saw what happened, right? As they said, everybody use the same technology for DCT. I'm going to give you a telehealth package, an e-consent package, I'm going to give you way too much technology, and then I'm going to deploy it to you, and everything's going to be great. And site said, I can't do this. Like, I know you, company A, are comfortable with this technology package across your entire study, but I have 50 studies, and I now have 50 technology platforms being pushed at me. I'm going to use my own. And in COVID, they figured out how to use their own. And so I think that's what we're really talking about, is incorporating the variability of practices into our operations in DCT models and getting everyone comfortable with the fact that practices do things differently. And that has always been the case. And it is a key component of how DCT will be successful.
So it just seems to me that evolution has been historically, these are science experiments at the end of the day. So science experiments, you try and control the variables, and the scale of it wasn't, it was just very research orientated science. As we find there's more and more protocols, exponentially more, and we realize that we have to be beyond the walls of the academic centers. What you're describing is kind of the evolution of science experiments, a very, supposedly pristine locations only, just don't work for the pipeline that we have, and then we have to change the model. Does that kind of reframe us also what you're saying?
Absolutely. I mean, the science experiment really exists to have data, and the data needs to be consistent and have all the other things intact, like compliance, quality, and be queryable. So that's our fear factor, is like if we do things a little bit different operationally, we might have bad data for some reason. And again, I think it's about making sure that we just literally have these conversations and talk through how that's not going to be impacted negatively.
Great.
Well, I want to make sure for folks who are joining us live, if you have the opportunity, feel free to share any questions in the chat box or let us know if you'd like to come off mute and share any questions with us. For folks that are joining us on a replay or podcast, remember, that's always one of the fun things about joining us live when we gather here on Fridays. You get to jump in and join in on the conversation. While we're waiting to see if there are any questions here in the room, one build that I wanted to go back to, we were talking earlier about this role for community oncologists who are not investigators and how to get those other locations kind of research accessible to expand our reach for participation. Are there any surprises that you've had when you're working with oncology clinics that are not research locations? Anything that's been surprising or eye-opening for you as you're engaging with those types of practices about how to have their patients participate in research without them becoming an investigator?
Well, I would say actually the answer is no. No surprises, because we're really sitting on this on the space of saying, hey, as an example, Texas Oncology was talking about this yesterday. They have it figured out. Like Dr. Paulson knows how to work with McAllen, Texas, and knows that treating oncologist and can see everything, does everything on their technology platform. So I and having worked on the sponsor side, did not have a concern in having worked with Texas Oncology in this model with like, does Dr. Scott Paulson know Dr. So-and-so in McAllen, Texas? That's actually, he'll say this, that's his burden that he carries. He's only as the PI comfortable in working with certain locations and certain investigators to make sure everything stays intact, to make sure that they're following their playbook for DCT. And so he's the one defining who is it that is a treating oncologist that I'm going to bring into my DCT model, and then I'm going to make sure adheres to the compliance and the regulations that they themselves as a practice have stood up. So as a life sciences partner, even at the network level, I'm not doing the convincing or the oversight of that. And I think this is an important point. It's a great question. That's something that actually the PI is doing with his footprint in this example of Texas Oncology.
So how does it flip if I'm just making this up? Like, what if the community oncologist has a patient who has already said, listen, I found a trial, I want to be in it, but they're not part of a research site. So can the activation happen at the patient level,
Yeah.
or does it always happen at the PI level?
Exactly. Well, I would say it's both. So we might activate that participating site. Again, that's like in this example, Texas Oncology has defined who they're going to work with in that those locations. And then they want to say, yes, I want to have a study deployed at this participating site, but I'm going to be the PI of that site. And their model already accounts for this. Like it does not happen overnight, right? Like he's already said, this is my geography, these are my locations, and this is my site base that could have the study. And then sure enough, the data surfaces, or the patient raises their hand, whatever happens, that this particular site location is then identified as the patient's base, so to speak. Again, from a regs perspective, you call that the participating site. And then the PI says, yes, I'm comfortable with that study and that oversight and that patient, and let's go. So it is at the PI level and it is at that site level. And whenever I get into these questions, again, having with pharma or even with the FDA, as we had some exchange with them, it was so here's a great example that happens every day. In the real world, these patients show up at the ER. And that ER is not where the PI is not sitting at the front door saying, "Welcome to the EI." They have this location may not even be at all affiliated with that investigator's location. And I'm not saying we should treat DCTs like it's a, dissociated ER, but what happens is the site figures out how to go get the data out of the ER visits, how to follow up with the patient on what happened, how to work with something that happened with that patient care that was unplanned for. If that's an everyday occurrence in oncology clinical research, then imagine if you already know that this is a potential site, you already know this investigator, you're on all the same technology platform. It's just an example of like this real world that these sites live in and what they already are doing to chase down all the data and everything that happened with the patient is so much more complex than a predefined DCT model.
I have a question through the chat from Archana. Archana is wondering about geography and global. And so is the Tempus Time work exclusively in the US today? Are there ex-US sites or will there be ex-US sites?
Tempus Time is US-based only today. Every single day, Carla and I are finger crossing that we have a larger, more global reach. I would say we are, again, blessed in that our network is data connected. And so it's one of the reasons why we haven't jumped over the pond, so to speak, overnight, but it is something that we are working on.
Does Tempus proper operate globally, or is their genomics and other data assets mostly US-based as well?
The easy answer is mostly US-based, but yes, we definitely have our CRO has global partners. We have global partners across the board, even from a genomic standpoint. Yes, we have a global reach. Majority still yes within the US.
So, taking geography, can I just go hyperlocal? So, I understand Houston is a very large metropolitan area, right? And I know that MD Anderson has an oversized reputation. So, I'm just going to pretend to be a patient. I've referred many patients not in Texas to go to MD Anderson, right? So, there's people coming to MD Anderson from other places in the world. So, if I'm an oncology patient, even in Houston, let's say, why would I go to a non-MD Anderson oncology place when I've got MD Anderson in Houston? How does that work? Why do these other centers, is it just because they're too far away to drive to MD Anderson? And also, if I'm a patient who is in Colorado, but I've been referred, to go to MD Anderson by, I don't want to live in Houston for next year, I want to be in a trial. I'm assuming our state licensure means that you don't really have hybrid trials where MD Anderson or any other Texas kind of coordinating center could actually run a patient living back in Colorado if you don't have a site there. Can you tell me about those two things?
Sure. We had a terrific webinar panelist yesterday from OSU, Dr. Roy Chowdhury, and he is an investigator again at an academic center. And the way that he broke through the walls of his academic center for a DCT model is he said, "I'll be the PI of my study, and I will deploy my study to any research site that wants to be added." And yes, that would mean a sub-I at that location. I will deploy my study to you when a patient has popped up. So he's adding research sites and sub-Is to the study that he is the PI of. And so I think that we can think about academic centers breaking through, again, their four walls of academia and reach their community or the community by doing a similar model as well. And I do think, well, we know statistically speaking that patients that cannot pay for in the Houston area, it is an hour and a half drive from where I live in traffic to the medical center. It is a $25 minimum parking fee as well for every single time you do that. That is extremely cost prohibitive and resource limiting for a majority of patients who live in our area. So we do see very successful community-based locations, including MD Anderson locations. They have figured out, like, if you reach out and you build it, they will come because of those reasons alone. Statistically, we know this is where DCT fits, right? The patient does not have to have the means, the time, and the money to, drive into an academic medical center to access the trial. We are more likely to capture that patient when we are in their community and closer to home.
That's great.
We do have another question in the chat. This one coming from our friend Rodrigo Garcia, who is another traveler between sponsor side and services side as well. Rodrigo's asking about use of technology at different locations and concerns around variability. That when we're talking about core tools like EDC and eCOA and e-consent forms, there's the pro of letting sites use more of their own technology and the con of risks and fears, whether reality or perception, around variability. And so are there strategies that you've seen to help mitigate some of that variability when we're letting sites use some of their own tooling?
Or are we just making stuff up again?
Absolutely not. I completely agree, right? At the end of the day, the data enrollment is great. We want to put patients on clinical trials, but ultimately, it's critical that we have the data, and that is the integrity of the data remains. So, from a technology perspective, we understand that our practices or organizations that have a DCT model set up, they are using the same technology across their organization. So the data is all being collected from the same platform, right? We're all on maybe the same EMR. The EDC system is going to be the same, right? The sponsor dictates this is where we enter our data. And best practice really has been having a dedicated data team, right? And this is not just for DCT. We understand that our practices are extremely busy, so they are working on becoming efficient and streamlining their process because they understand that data is critical. So most of our practices really have dedicated data teams that are pulling and making sure that the data integrity and they're following up on data entry within the specified timelines, data queries, working to resolve with the nurses, investigators to make sure that they're remaining on one of the most valuable things, which is ultimately making sure the data integrity stays the same. So just like they would for any other trial, I would say our practices are leveraging their same EDC, EHR platforms and making sure they have a streamlined approach. Many times having a center data team that's going to be able to access the data if it's a, if I'm a site in Houston, Texas, but maybe I have a location that has a patient that's enrolled, I'll just say Dallas, right? But it's the same platform. I have access to all of the information I need, and I'm following to make sure that I'm entering the data, following the guidelines that the sponsor has dictated.
There
So
we go. I
we're
think there's
getting to
time
the
for
end.
one last question, right, Jane, from our room here. I see a comment here from Justin that maybe Noelle you'd like to just comment on for folks that are listening in. Justin was asking about advancing community practices as subsites as a possible strategy, but comes with a lot of administrative overhead and cost. So I think you had in the comments a couple of thoughts there as far as some strategies for getting around that.
Yeah, so first, just as it relates to time, we would have the data, like how many patients are potentially there. Sponsors make informed decisions about what sites they're going to activate because we can see that. And that, of course, mitigates your cost concern or risk. But yeah, blanketing the United States and saying everybody, is a subsite is not feasible. So that's where, again, if the patient is identified through the data, you are making the informed decision of I will activate that location because I know that this patient is eligible and that the data is robust enough to confirm that. or potentially eligible, I should say, at least enough to consent. So I think you mitigate your cost concerns there by opening up locations again where there's data to qualify that these patients are there and that then you're only opening the study at that point and having a non-enrolling cost eliminated from your budget. So I think that's an important part of thinking about how do I bring more studies to the community is working with data and working with not just Tyme, but there's other networks, just to be honest, out there who can help, bridge the questions, the concerns around like what is happening with this practice? Is it worth opening? The other thing I would say from a decentralized trial model is that we are not saying that these participating sites are research sites. So if you read the regulations, you don't actually have to send your CRO to the participant site and do the due diligence and everything that you would do for a research site. It's actually a lighter lift. And so that should be factored into your cost assessments. And we have actually found both on the sponsor side and in these models working at the network level that this is actually a more cost-effective model than a traditional open up the site and pray that the patient comes in. As again, we're hoping to identify that there are patients in advance with the data and that we are only, and when we're reaching patients more effectively and having more successful enrollment because we're eliminating the barriers that we all know exist in a traditional model.
Okay, I can't hold myself back. When is this going to work beyond oncology?
That's a great question. I think it's so much easier every other indication. So I feel selfish talking a lot about oncology, but obviously that's my experience. But I'm like, if it can happen in oncology, why can't it happen everywhere else? Oh my gosh, we are dealing with very sick patients and very toxic at times, therapeutics. So, we had one oncology yesterday present their real-world evidence model that's a DCT model so that they can collect data from these community practices and not have the burden of a traditional activation for a study. And that actually opens up the windows for data coming in from these locations that previously would not have participated on an observational or real-world evidence study. So, I think that's obviously oncology practices, but that tells you this could be so much more in other indications. And we've seen some success, particularly in cardiology and PCORI and what Duke has done in that space. And absolutely, I think we should be leveraging it in all indications, if at all possible. If you can do it in oncology, again, I would say you can do it almost anywhere.
I'm so happy you said that because 5 years ago, people were like, oh, this DCT stuff is going to work everywhere except oncology. I was like, no, that's where it really has to work.
Yeah,
Really has to work.
don't tell that to the Oncology Center of Excellence at FDA, right?
Right.
They're not afraid. Well, I think that gets us right to the top of the hour. And so, Noelle, Carla, I'd like to thank you for joining us today and sharing the cool work you're doing there with the Tyme Network. Really appreciate the chance to learn more and appreciate our friends Archana, Justin, Rodrigo for your questions that you were able to bring into the conversation. I hope everybody stays warm out there. Even you, Amir, out there in the in
The
Southern
wilds of
California.
Southern Cal.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you for
Thank
having
you.
us.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Happy Friday. Bye.
Bye-bye.